I know you're out there. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
The Chris Ann Hall Show.
Any varmint that crosses that lady's path has met its match. Come on!
Rise and shine, liberty-loving patriots. Welcome to the Chris Ann Hall Show. We are not a talk show. We are a teach show. We will not tune in here and have a regurgitation of the news so that you can have more emotional ammunition to get angry and scream and shout. This is a show about problems and solutions. I'm going to show you what's going on. I'm going to show you what's going wrong, and we are going to find the solutions to those problems. Now, before we get started, I want to give you our five NSA flag words for today. Yesterday, I totally forgot to post the NSA flag words on my Facebook page and Twitter, but we do announce them every single day, and so I've got to catch up here today. I think I'll probably be posting 10 NSA flag words on Facebook and Twitter today just to make up for the fact that I forgot yesterday. But here are your NSA flag words today. Remember, use your words or lose your words. Don't be a slave. Don't be a coward. Speak up, speak out, and use these words, because it's absolutely ridiculous that the NSA has made these words illegal. So are you ready? Here are your five NSA flag words for today. ICE. Flashbangs. Spies. Ninja. Toad. ICE. Flashbangs. Spies. Ninja. Toad. Yes, these are five words that the NSA says will trigger a response of them being able to search and seize your computer, your cell phone, and your property without a warrant. If you say the words ICE, flashbangs, spies, ninja, toad, you have now been flagged by the NSA flagging programs, and they will now be monitoring you as a potential terrorist because you say ICE, flashbangs, spies, ninja, toad. And so now make sure that you use these words every single day and you use them with frequency, especially today. And this is the purpose of the NSA flag word test, is to make sure that we are using these words so that they cannot make them illegal. Now, the interesting thing about this today is that, you know, the whole use or lose aspect of our rights often springs from a misunderstanding of the proper role of the government. What is the government's proper power? What is the government's proper limitation of that power? And we have to make sure that we are keeping the government within its proper limits. And that takes a personal responsibility, because the federal government is not going to limit itself. We are going to talk about something very important today, a mechanism of this current administration, and something that apparently is not opposed by any congressman, because you're not hearing about this anywhere. This administration attempting to make foreign law trump the Constitution. Foreign law trumping state law. And that's where we are. So we're going to talk about this very important case called Bond v. United States. Daniel Webster said on July 4th, 1806, "Is the Constitution worth preserving?" He said, "Then guard it as you would the very seat of your life. Guard it not only against the open blows of violence, but also against that spirit of change." We should be about the business of protecting our Constitution. The Supremacy Clause reads, "This Constitution." I think that's significant there. "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. This is very important. This Constitution, number one, foremost, is the supreme law of the land. When you read this grammatically, this Constitution, nothing else, this Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. So, any law made by Congress is only supreme law of the land when it's made in pursuance to the Constitution. So, any legislative act contrary to the Constitution outside federal authority is not the supreme law of the land and is not lawful. It just simply can't be upheld according to the Supremacy Clause. And now we continue with, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. Well, what is the authority of the United States? Well, those are the laws which are made in pursuance to the Constitution. So you see, the Constitution is still the supreme law of the land. No law, legislative act contrary to the Constitution can be valid. Alexander Hamilton said that in Federalist Paper 78. But where does treaties come into this? Well, treaties are simply foreign contracts. The whole purpose of a treaty is a contract. Our founders repeatedly stated that treaties were, for every purpose and application, contracts, agreements with foreign nations to accomplish the duties, obligations in the delegated powers of the federal government. What are the delegated powers of the federal government? Well, Alexander Hamilton teaches us the federal government is delegated certain powers. He tells us the powers in Federalist 45, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined and will be exercised principally on external objects as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. Okay, so the only powers delegated to your federal government are external object powers, meaning foreign affairs, and then listed war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. Now, here's another catch, because somebody's going to tell you, what about the general welfare clause? What about the tax and spending clause? What about the necessary and proper clause? Well, we're going to get into that, but Madison continues in 45 with an explanation of the tax and spending clause. He says, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined and will be exercised principally on external objects as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce, with which the last power of taxation will, for the most part, be connected. You see, the tax and spending clause is connected to the duty of the federal government and is applied to external objects. The federal government has no sovereignty on its own. It can make no decisions without the will of the people through Congress and the consent of the states through the Senate. And so when it engages in its lawful use of power, war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce, it needs money to do that. And so it must tax in order to engage in war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. That is the only tax and spending power that was delegated to the federal government. Our federal government was designed to be our national representative to the foreign world, a representative of the country in foreign nations. Because we lived in a world where nations were led by kings and czars and emperors, we needed to have a way that all the states could have a unified voice for negotiations and commerce. During the Articles of Confederation, our federal government could not collect taxes or even compel the delegates to show up to work and do their job. The federal government was attempting to make agreements with foreign nations, but they were defaulting on these agreements because they had no authority to enforce them equally throughout the states, and the states themselves were suffering the consequences. This is what was reported in the Address and Reason of Dissent of the Minority of the Convention of Pennsylvania and their constituents, December 12, 1787. Quote, it was found that our national character was sinking in the opinion of foreign nations. Congress could make treaties of commerce, but could not enforce the observance of them. We were suffering from the restrictions of foreign nations who had shackled our commerce while we were unable to retaliate. And all now agree that it would be advantageous to the Union to enlarge the powers of Congress, that they should be enabled to, in the amplest manner, to regulate commerce and lay and collect duties upon the imports throughout the United States. Why? To engage in foreign commerce. Not to regulate state commerce. Not to regulate individual commerce. But to regulate commerce so that we could conduct business internationally. And the purpose of this was so that the states would not be suffering from the threat of foreign war because of broken treaty agreements. See, the other problem with these treaties were that the federal government was not engaging in equitable treaties among the states. That was the purpose of the General Welfare Clause. To instruct the federal government that when they engage in treaties, they must do it for the general welfare of the entire union, not to benefit one state and detriment the other, because that was creating conflict between the states. We were on the verge of a civil war, and we were on the verge of a foreign war, because these treaties were made inequitably, and the states were unable to honor them. And the federal government could not enforce them, because they had no power to do so, they had no money to do so. So, treaties were given supremacy because the collective decision was made not only to delegate power of treaties to the President and Senate, but also to classify its relevance and enforcement over the states. There was a great debate over this issue. Many were concerned that by designating this power, it would elevate treaties above the Constitution itself. Fortunate for us, this argument was made, because the rebuttal to this argument is vital in understanding the limitation and scope of treaties. Without these explanations, treaties created by the federal government might justifiably supersede the Constitution. Good thing for us that these treaties, although they may attempt to supplant the Constitution, they are plainly not justified to do so. Our founders repeatedly stated that treaties were, for every purpose and application, contracts, and they were limited in its scope and power to the limitation of the delegated, limited and defined delegated power to the federal government. And when we come back after the break, we're going to discuss those limitations, because it's something that our Supreme Court doesn't understand, something that our Congress doesn't understand, and something that this administration is more than willing to take advantage of our ignorance. It is time for we the people to stand up and stop being ignorant.
Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
So we are going to be talking about Bond v. United States today. Eric Holder is attempting to make treaties trump state law and trump the Constitution. But we are going to learn today why that's not possible. Treaties cannot do that. Treaties are limited to the defined and limited powers of the federal government. Madison tells us those powers are limited to external objects, foreign affairs, war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. And the tax and spending clause, the necessary proper clause, the general welfare clause are all tied to those things. They are not the expansion of power. They are the definition and the purpose of those powers. The general welfare clause, the taxations clause, the necessary proper clause do not expand the power of the government. They describe the purpose of the power. Now, in our history, the argument was made that if we expand the federal government's power in this treaty making power, we will give the power to the federal government to trump the Constitution via treaties. Now, that's not possible. There are agreements. These contracts are agreements with foreign nations to accomplish the duties obligated in those four delegated powers Madison identified. In Federal 75, it says, the power of making treaties is, plainly, neither one nor the other. It relates neither to the execution of subsisting laws, nor the enaction of new ones, and still less to the exertion of the common strength. Here's what treaties are. Treaties. Its objects are contracts with foreign nations which have the force of law but derive it from the obligation of good faith. They are not rules prescribed by the sovereign to the subject, but agreements between sovereign and sovereign. Do you catch that? They are not rules prescribed by the sovereign to the subject, but agreements between sovereign and sovereign. They are not rules by the federal government to be applied to the people, but the agreements to be between one government to another. Now, all these contracts were not considered to be a subdivision of laws or even new laws altogether. It was necessary that they were binding upon the states to prevent the failure seen by our founders in the Articles of Confederation. But the treaties were not designed to be untouchable. They were subject to the very same checks and balances of every act of the federal government. They could fail if they didn't meet proper standards. One way they could fail is if they attempted to infringe upon or utilize a power that had not been granted to them through the Constitution. They were to be bound and fettered by all limitations of power inherent in the Constitution through the specific delegated powers and the necessary and proper and general welfare clauses. To us, that statement sounds like an oxymoron, right? To think that the necessary and proper and general welfare clauses were meant to bind Congress. And that's because we've become so detached from the founders' intent, we have allowed these clauses to become an expansion of power and the consequences that our founders thought an abomination. And if a treaty attempted to assume a power that was not previously delegated, for instance, to bind upon the states an agreement for an object outside the realm of war, peace, or foreign commerce, it would be deemed unconstitutional. Listen to what Jefferson wrote in 1793. I insisted that in giving the President and Senate a power to make treaties, the Constitution meant only to authorize them to carry into effect by way of treaty any powers they might constitutionally exercise. Jefferson wrote in 1800 in the Parliamentary Manual, by the general power to make treaties, the Constitution must have intended to comprehend that only those subjects which are usually regulated by treaty, war, peace, foreign commerce, cannot be otherwise regulated. It must have meant to accept out of these rights reserved to the states. For surely the President and the Senate cannot do by treaty what the whole government is interdicted from doing in any way. Do you see that? If it is not a delegated power, then they don't have the power to do it via treaty. They don't have the power to dictate to the states how to do that. They do not have the power to write law for the states, and they do not have the power to govern the individual via treaty. Another limitation imposed by our founders is that the treaties must not be in conflict with the Constitution. Hamilton said no legislative act contrary to the Constitution can be valid. There is no law superior to the Constitution. So what do we do when the treaties fail the test of constitutional limitations? We are not stuck with these treaties. We are not stuck with making a constitutional amendment to supplant them. That's not the perspective that's consistent with our founders.
My mom always said I was born for this, and some people wouldn't like that I was different. It never really mattered how hard it would be, because she filled me with love and the strength to live. She said,
the Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
In this argument back and to about the expansion of power of Congress for the enforcement of treaties, great argument was made with great clarification as to why treaties do not trump. And our founders wanted us to know that if a treaty was in opposition to the Constitution, there would be significant consequences. Federalist 64 explains that, it, quote, if they, the President and the Senate, act corruptly, they can be punished. And if they make disadvantageous treaties, How are we to get rid of those treaties? As to corruption, the case is not supposable. He must either have been very fortunate in his intercourse with the world, meaning the president, or possess a heart very susceptible of such impressions. Who can think it probable? And this is one of the the way our founders underestimated just how wicked we would become. The Federalists, anyway. The Anti-Federalists got it right, but the Federalists got it wrong as just to how depraved we were. He said, who can think it probable that the President and two-thirds of the Senate will ever be capable of such an unworthy conduct of corruption? The idea, I'm quoting this now, the idea is too gross and too invidious to be entertained. But if such a case, if it should ever happen, the treaty so obtained from us, like all other fraudulent contracts, would be null and void by the law of nations. So you cannot be bound by an illegal contract. Nobody is bound by a legal illegal contract. And since the treaties are nothing more than contracts, if those contracts are made through corruption and made contrary to the Constitution, the framers told us you don't have anything to worry about because they're void and of no force, because there is absolutely unconstitutional. They're against the law. The simple fact of the matter is this. A treaty would be a fraudulent contract and would have no effect. Alexander Hamilton made the point of the ultimate check and balance in Federalist 33. Quote, if the federal government should overpass the bounds of its authority and make a tyrannical use of its power, the people whose creature it is must appeal to the standard they have formed and take such measures to redress the injury done to the Constitution as the exigency may suggest and prudence justify. The propriety of a law in a constitutional light must always be determined by the nature of the powers upon which it is founded. It would not be the supreme law of the land then, but the usurpation of power not granted by the Constitution. If you allow an act of the federal government to not be bound upon the nature of power which it was founded, war, peace, negotiation, foreign commerce, then the Constitution would not be the supreme law of the land, but would become the trumped by the laws of Congress. And then we would just simply be a kingdom. But that's what this administration wants. Eric Holder and the Department of Justice has made the argument in Bond v. United States that Section 229 of the Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act of 1998, which was established to criminalize biological warfare and the use of chemical warfare, reaches into, this is the argument, a conviction for simple assault arising from a woman who attempting to poison her husband's mistress by spreading chemicals on her doorknob, causing only a minor burn that would be easily treated with water. Now, Miss Bond has figured out that her husband is cheating on her with the neighbor. When her neighbor becomes pregnant with her husband's child, she is a biochemist. She takes chemicals from her laboratory and makes this plot, she says, to make this woman's life a living hell. She has just been cheated on by her husband, and now her husband's mistress is going to have her husband's child. And so she takes these chemicals and she puts them on the car door handle. She puts them on the mailbox. The lady figures out that there's chemicals come on her stuff, and she calls the police. When they find the chemicals on the mailbox, the police tell her to call the post office, okay? Because now it's a federal offense, interfering with mail. And so the post office sets up these cameras and they discover what is going on. Now, Eric Holder and the Department of Justice argue that the chemical weapons under 18 U.S.C. 229, a treaty that was created to bind foreign governments in the use of chemical weapons, should now be equally applied to this woman placing chemicals on her husband's mistress's doorknobs. That these treaties now, these foreign treaties, will now apply to individual citizens. Chemical warfare treaties can now be used to convict someone of a federal crime instead of a state felony or misdemeanor. This is an assault case. And we have a situation where there's been no physical damage. The woman was not harmed. It's a threat. In the very least, in the greatest at this point, okay? In the greatest charge that you could get from this at a criminal level, on the state level, is attempted murder. If you could somehow prove that these chemicals would cause death, then you could charge her with attempted murder. But now, the federal government has argued all the way to the Supreme Court that the prohibition on the use of a chemical weapon in 18 U.S.C. 229 applied to this woman's conduct, and that this application is constitutional. They're arguing that the Constitution allows them to do this. And it's absolutely ridiculous. And here's the argument. Congress had authority under both the Commerce and Treaty Powers Clauses, coupled with the Necessary and Proper Clause, to proscribe the petitioner's conduct. Do you see the expansion of power here now? We're using the Commerce Clause, the Treaty Powers Clause, and the Necessary and Proper Clause to apply a treaty that limits foreign governments from using chemical warfare to people on the local level. Now, here's the crazy thing, and this is where we get really, really out of whack. The Department of Justice argues that the federal prohibition on petitioner's use of toxic chemicals to harm another was also proper application of Congress's power to limit to implement treaties. Petitioner's attempt to carve out local conduct from the scope of treaty power echoes arguments that have been made and rejected since the founding. Now, you won't find those arguments since the founding. And the only court case that they will actually quote is Missouri v. Holland, which is a court case from 1920. Now, I'm going to tell you what. If these arguments had been made and rejected since the founding, those arguments would have been in there. They'd have been quoting Madison. They'd have been quoting Hamilton. They'd have been quoting Jay. They'd have been quoting the federal papers, the anti-federalist papers, but they did not. They brought up a case of Missouri v. Holland in 1920. Well, we'd already been inappropriately expanding the federal government's power since well before 1920. And what Missouri v. Holland does is take the expansions from 1803 and Madison, Marbury versus Madison, and defeats the argument that James Madison made in 1792 against this expansion of power. You see, you cannot use the federal government's self-created expansion of power to justify expanding greater power. The federal government was never supposed to do that. The courts were never, ever granted that power to expand their power. The states are supposed to be controlling this. But you see, the federal government wants to take treaty power and expand that to individual and local jurisdiction. James Madison warned us about that. James Madison warned us in 1792 that if we allow these clauses to be turned into defined powers, he says, if Congress can employ money indefinitely to the general welfare and are the sole and supreme judges of the general welfare, they may take care of religion into their own hands. They may appoint teachers in every state, county, and parish. They may pay them out of their public treasury. They may take into their own hands the education of children, establishing in like manner schools or curriculums throughout the Union. They may assume the provision for the poor. They may undertake the regulation of all roads other than post roads. In short, everything from the highest object of state legislation down to the most minute object of police would be thrown under the power of Congress. For every object I have mentioned would admit the application of money, and might be called, if Congress so pleased, provision for the general welfare. I venture to declare it as my opinion, that were the power of Congress to be established in the latitude contended for, it would subvert the very foundations and transmute the very nature of limited government established by the people of America. We have transmuted that. We have changed that. And now Eric Holder in this administration wants to take advantage of that, turning these treaty powers and the General Welfare Clause power into a tool to enforce foreign law at a local level. It can't be done. It cannot be done. And we can't allow it. Our framers said that if that happens, you just must simply declare those things to be null and void. You must declare on a local and state level, no, you can't do this. At the point that this happened to Ms. Bond, the state should have set up and said, no, you're not taking this out of our jurisdiction. This is not a federal issue. The sheriff should have refused to allow her to be prosecuted, and the judge should have immediately thrown it out. We cannot allow them to expand this treaty power to the local level, because guess what? The UN's arms treaty is coming your way, and this is the perfect thing they want to happen for the Supreme Court to say that they can do that. But I got really good news for you when we come back.
The Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist. Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
This argument that Eric Holder and the Department of Justice makes to bootstrap this chemical warfare treaty on the local level is absolutely ridiculous. But it is telling us what they want to do. This is how they want to disarm us, okay? They want to take these treaties and apply them on the local level and on the personal level. And what they're trying to do is say that this woman's act of potential violence, of violence on her neighbor, because it was not peaceful, it is warlike. That's their classification now. Because she didn't mean to peacefully poison her neighbor, we can now classify her activity as warfare. They say the history of the convention and its implementation of this legislation confirms the text's plain import, namely that its prohibitions extend beyond what petitioner characterizes as warlike use of chemicals. The convention was enacted to take, quote, a major step beyond the Geneva Protocol of 1925, which only banned the use in war of chemical agents. The convention's, quote, prohibition on the use of chemical weapons extends beyond solely their use in international armed conflicts, i.e., chemical weapons may not be used in any type of situation, including purely domestic conflicts, civil wars, or state-sponsored terrorism. So now they want to say that this woman who tried to poison her neighbor is somehow engaged in a domestic conflict, a civil war, or a state-sponsored terrorism. And they want to take this interpretation of this word's domestic conflicts and turn them into domestic between people. No, that's not what domestic conflict means in this application. But they're going to stretch it. Because let me tell you what, I have read the UN Arms Treaty, and this is the language that's in the UN Arms Treaty. This very language about limiting people on an individual level. You must go to my website. You must go to my website and read the articles and the analyses that I have done on the UN Arms Treaty and see why the UN Arms Treaty is unconstitutional and read it. I have given you the language of the UN Arms Treaty that will show you that once we're in, we can't get out, and how it will create a national debate database that will report every gun owner to the United Nations for ruling and reigning. And we have now made the argument via the federal government that these treaties can now be applied on individuals, trumping constitution and state law. And this is exactly what they wanted to do. Now, the good news is the Supreme Court shot this argument down on June 2nd, 2014, July 7th, issuing their judgment. They said that the federal government's, the Department of Justice reading of this treaty would transform a statute concerned with the acts of war, assassination, and terrorism into a massive federal anti-poisoning regime that reaches the simplest of assaults, in light of the principle that Congress does not normally intrude upon states' police powers. This court is reluctant to conclude that the Congress meant to punish simple crimes with federal prosecution for chemical weapons attacks. They said, in fact, only a handful of these prosecutions have been brought under Section 229, and most of those involve crimes not traditionally within the state's purview, terrorist plots. They concluded that Pennsylvania's laws are sufficient to prosecute assaults like this case, and there is no indication that Section 229 In 229, that Congress intended to abandon its traditional reluctance to define as a federal crime conduct readily denounced as criminal by the state. The principle goes to the very structure of the Constitution and protects the liberty of the individual from arbitrary power. The global need to prevent chemical warfare does not require the federal government to reach into the kitchen cupboard. And we should be rejoicing at this point in time that the Supreme Court got it right. Because they could have got it wrong, which they have over and over again. But this is not going to be their last attempt. They will make this effort. This was just testing the waters, playing out their argument and getting the federal Supreme Court's response. We'd better learn how to nullify now. We had better learn how to stand for our liberty, because the real attack is coming. It is coming, America, and it will be through the court system. It will be through these foreign laws and foreign treaties. Wake up. Wake up, America.